Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author and commentator Dr. Earl Afari Hutchinson, who assesses the failed campaign to deny confirmation to former Missouri Senator John Ashcroft as the nation's attorney general. John Cavanaugh, executive director of the Institute for Policy Studies, who takes a look at the post-election battle between conservatives and progressives within the Democratic Party and the nation at large. And Dan Christensen, an investigative journalist with the Miami-based Daily Business Review, who recounts the campaign finance irregularities of right-wing Cuban-American Republican Congressman Lincoln Diaz-Balart of Florida. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The World Press Review magazine reports that white separatist political groups are gaining new support in the American South. In a major development, Wayne Willingham, a member of the Southern Party, which advocates secession, was elected last fall as mayor of West Point, Alabama. The Southern Party is an offshoot of the League of the South, a growing movement that blasts multiculturalism and sees itself in the mold of Italy's Northern League or Canada's Quebecois. The appeal of white separatists is growing in part from the flap to take the Confederate flag down from Southern state capitals. Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors white supremacist groups, says the growing acceptance of white separatists has created a veneer of moral legitimacy for people who would be embarrassed to join the Ku Klux Klan. The League of the South was founded in 1994 by history professor Michael Hill and has over 9,000 members. Other groups tracked by the Southern Poverty Law Center include the Council of Conservative Citizens, the Heritage Preservation Association, and the Confederate States of America, which seeks to repeal laws that gave voting rights to blacks and women. Not surprising to many who report on the white supremacist movement, Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, Republican from Mississippi, endorsed the racist Council of Conservative Citizens until press reports embarrassed him into renouncing the group in 1998. More recently, Bush Attorney General John Ashcroft was revealed in Senate confirmation hearings to have conducted an interview with and endorsed the Southern Partisan magazine, which defends the politics and philosophy of the Confederacy. The Nation magazine reports that there is a strange buzz surrounding new Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, who took the post after retiring from aluminum giant Alcoa. Supply-side Republicans are wondering if he has enough fire to lead the charge for big tax cuts. Trade unions say O'Neill is a fair bargainer and may find ways to shore up America's sagging industrial economy. George Becker, president of the Steelworkers Union, describes O'Neill as an industrialist who believes in the United States and has maintained a need for a strong industrial base, adding, "I think this is far better than having another bond trader on the job." Becker recalls, "I had people I could talk to in the Clinton administration. They would listen and tell me how much they understood my pain. Then they went out and deep-sixed us." With the fear that the American economy may be sinking into recession, O'Neill's prime job will be to sell the Bush administration's massive $1.6 trillion tax cut that critics say will give away 40% of all benefits to the richest taxpayers. Over the long term, many Wall Street traders fear that O'Neill won't be able to handle a major international debt crisis. They are pressing for O'Neill to pick an investment banker for his top deputy, someone like former Clinton Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, who is now chairman of Citigroup. Parents used to worry about the influence cigarette makers had on their children. Now the concern is over schools that have sold out to soda companies, according to Mother Jones magazine. Sugar-laden soft drinks have been linked to broken bones, osteoporosis, diabetes, and kidney stones. It is most damaging to the young, however, since they're still in the process of growing. Grace Wyshak, a professor at Harvard's School of Public Health, has demonstrated that 9th and 10th grade girls with a thirst for soda were 3 times more likely to break bones than their peers, and soda-addicted active girls were 5 times more likely to suffer broken bones. A South African study carried out in 1999 posited a clear link between soda and kidney stones. Additional studies imply the presence of caffeine in soda may be the reason for the increasing incidence of children's sleep disorders. Finally, sugar has been scrutinized as the culprit in the increasing obesity of the young. Soda makers have targeted schools as an up-and-coming market. The Center for Commercial Free Public Education finds that 240 school districts in 31 states have linked up with the big three, Dr. Pepper, Pepsi, and Coke. In the words of Michael Jacobson, executive director of the Center for Science in the Public Interest, many teens are drowning in worthless sugar water. Parents should limit their children's soda consumption and demand that schools get rid of soft drink vending machines, just as they have banished smoking. This week's news summary was compiled by Rich Frazier and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Despite vocal opposition by many progressive groups across the country, the U.S. Senate confirmed John Ashcroft as Attorney General by a 58-42 vote. Although the Senate Judiciary Committee examined Ashcroft's association with white supremacist groups and a history of opposition to abortion, civil rights, and gay rights, eight Democrats voted to confirm the former Missouri senator, apparently believing his pledge to uphold all the laws he has spent his entire career working to overturn. The Democratic leadership spun their defeat as a warning to the Bush administration that with their 42 votes, they will have the ability to obstruct future extremist nominations to the Supreme Court. As Attorney General, John Ashcroft will supervise 130,000 employees of the Justice Department and advise Bush on future appointments to the federal bench as well as the Supreme Court. Ashcroft will also have vast power over federal enforcement of reproductive rights laws, the hate crime statute, racial profiling, the death penalty, and drug sentencing disparity. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with author and commentator Dr. Earl Lafari Hutchinson, who assesses the failed campaign to deny confirmation of John Ashcroft and the battles that lie ahead over the next 4 years.
It's bad news all the way around. The Democrats, including those that voted for him, and certainly those that voted against him, for that matter, many of them reluctantly, and I mean extremely, were extremely reluctant to vote against him. Some even said, like Lay from Vermont, that he may have had a confirmation conversion. It seemed like on some of the issues he said the right things. For example, he will enforce the law, all civil rights laws, and that includes abortion rights. He will be tough on mergers. He will not torpedo the consent decrees that are in place now with police departments. We have one out here in Los Angeles, and I believe there's another one in Pittsburgh. He'll be an attorney general for all the people. We've heard that before with George Bush. He'll be a president of all the people and for all the people. Well, I think anybody that believes that we have some palm trees to sell to you in Connecticut tonight, and you can plant them right now, and I'm sure they'll grow. The fact of the matter is, all you have to do is look at his record. As Attorney General, let's start with him as Attorney General. We don't have to speculate about it, what he'll do in the future. Let's look at what he did when he was Attorney General in the state of Missouri. And he was Attorney General for 4 years. And one of the major things, right off the top, John Ashcroft waged a relentless battle, I mean an unmerciful battle, against school desegregation in St. Louis. There was a decree, a federal enforced court decree, that John Ashcroft battled against. He tried to have it overturned. He said, we don't need it. We don't need that. There's nothing wrong with the schools. There's balance there as it is. This is racial gerrymandering and tinkering. We don't need this kind of thing. So Ashcroft went to the wall on that. And I think when you look at his record closely up and down the line on issues like gun control, on issues like reproductive rights, and obviously all the range of civil rights issues, as Attorney General, this guy was an obstructionist. We have over 80 positions now in the federal judiciary that are up for grabs. By that I mean president-elect or select or appointed or anointed, however you want to go with it, George Bush will have the say-so over those judges. And he will rely on the Attorney General for advice. Now we come to the Supreme Court. We know that with 4 years of a Bush administration and perhaps 8 years of a Bush administration, it doesn't leave much to the imagination to know that we've got a few aging judges on the Supreme Court. We've got a couple of them that have battled cancer. They're in ill health. So it appears that he will certainly have the opportunity to pick one, two, maybe three or four justices to the Supreme Court if he lasts in the White House 8 years. And it's reasonable to expect, barring some miracle from heaven, that John Ashcroft will be Attorney General for 8 years. He'll be sitting right there advising G.W. Bush on what kind of judges to pick. Ashcroft and Bush have made it clear over and over again the judges that they like are Clarence Thomas, Rehnquist, and Scalia. They have said publicly they are our favorite judges. So those are the kind of judges that you'll get on the Supreme Court if they have anything to do with it, and those are the kind of judges they'll pack, I mean, throughout the federal system, judges with. So we're looking at a nightmare, 4 years, perhaps 8 years under Ashcroft.
The Democrats' assessment of their 42 votes cast against the Ashcroft nomination was that it was a shot over the bow of the Republican Party not to go too far. Number one, they said that they do have the votes now to sustain a filibuster to prevent an arch-conservative from being nominated to the Supreme Court. Some of the Democrats have also promised to hold Ashcroft to his commitment to enforce the law that many suspect was the result of a confirmation conversion. What do you think the potential is that the Democrats will follow through and will play hardball with the Republicans? Do you think the Democrats are up to the task?
Yes and no. They're up to it. They have the votes. They show that. They can bottle up. They can filibuster. And so, yeah, it's there. But remember, those Democrats, Scott, the 42, many of the 42 that voted against Ashcroft in the confirmation, they didn't just do it because they had the, you know, this great sentiment, this their own conversion, political conversion, saw the light about Ashcroft, were just mortally in danger or terrified by what Ashcroft would represent in the Justice Department, at the head of the Justice Department. They did that because of mass, and I mean massive, political pressure from their traditional constituents and their traditional base. Probably the only silver lining in all of this is that what you may see is perhaps a law of unintended consequences with the John Ashcroft in there, and that is sometimes it takes a visible enemy, it takes kind of a devil at the door to wake people up and say there's someone there, there's a barbarian at the gate that we need to oppose. I think you're in for a battle royal for these years, coming years under Ashcroft and Bush. And I think what will happen, Scott, is that you're going to see kind of a pickup again of momentum on the part of a lot of diverse groups out there on the other side of the political spectrum that may get new life.
That was author and commentator Dr. Earl Afari Hutchinson. Contact his group, the National Alliance for Positive Action, at area code 310-672-2542. Or visit their website at www.natalliance.org. The corporate media and many Democrats are tripping over themselves to heap praise on President George W. Bush's first weeks in office for what they say are his promotion of bipartisanship on Capitol Hill. The Bush charm offensive, however, is viewed by many as camouflage for the hard right political decisions made in the controversial nominations of John Ashcroft as Attorney General, Gail Norton as Interior Secretary, and a collection of Cold Warriors in national security posts. Despite opposition from Senate Democrats, all the Bush nominees were eventually confirmed. Owing an important political debt to the Christian right, Mr. Bush's first executive order cut federal spending to overseas clinics that offered abortion counseling or services. Meanwhile, the Democrats were assessing the political landscape, which for the first time since 1955 saw the Republican Party in control of the White House and both houses of Congress. The Conservative Democratic Leadership Council, with which Bill Clinton has long been associated, concluded that their party lost the White House because Al Gore campaigned on an outdated populist platform that was too liberal for most Americans. The DLC also concluded that votes cast for the progressive agenda of the Green Party's Ralph Nader were insignificant. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Cavana, executive director of the Institute for Policy Studies, who takes a look at the post-election battle between conservatives and progressives within the Democratic Party and the nation at large.
Well, I think one thing that we should recognize about George Bush, he is not stupid. He's not very much into policy. He doesn't like policy, which makes you wonder why he wants to be president of the United States. But he is surrounded by people who are very smart political operatives. And what they did these first 2 weeks was, in some ways, smart from a political standpoint. On the one hand, they threw out major, large bones to their very conservative religious base, which forms the activists of the Republican Party, in the nominations for cabinet positions that you mentioned and in the family planning announcement, and in one or two other smaller announcements. So he keeps his base very, very happy. At the same time, he recognizes, and his party recognizes, that they have no mandate to run this country, and they won't get anything done if they don't reach out to the so-called moderate part of the Democratic Party. I mean, keep in mind that 52% of people in this country voted either for Ralph Nader or Al Gore, and public opinion polls showed that people much more liked the social agenda and the overall policies of the Democrats. They simply didn't like Al Gore, a deeply flawed candidate. So the Republicans know this. And therefore, they start with their big policy announcement of the first week that is perhaps least controversial, although there are controversial aspects to it, and that is education. And he came out and said he was open to moves the Democrats might want to make. Well, that's pure political survival. So they were clever, I would say. I mean, brutal in terms of the impact of these policies. That family planning policy is death to hundreds of thousands of people in Africa and elsewhere. So it's a brutal policy, but it shores up his base. And at the same time, he reaches out to modern Democrats who are disappointing many people in that party for the weakness with which they're approaching Bush. I think one of the major struggles of these next few months will be a struggle over the soul of that Democratic Party between those who really come from a base of working people, of environmentalists, women's groups, and so on, who've been the activist base of that party versus the mainstream center-right core of it, which more and more is in bed with business interests, and which you saw with the people who caved on the Ashcroft nomination and went, eight Democrats went and voted for this man who is as far from what a traditional Democrat was as you possibly could be.
There was a recent assessment of the 2000 election. The Conservative Democratic Leadership Council concluded that Al Gore lost his bid for the White House because he campaigned on an outdated populist platform that was too liberal for most Americans. And the report also concluded that the Nader votes were insignificant. It was DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council members Bill Clinton and Al Gore, who have driven the Democratic Party further to the right over the past 8 years. And now, for the first time since 1955, we have the Republicans in control of the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives, and effective control, of course, in the U.S. Supreme Court. What do you make of this assessment by the Democratic Leadership Council?
It's ludicrous, and I think they know it, and I'm amazed they try to get away with it. What happened in this election was Al Gore ran a lethargic campaign that was quite a failure. He was way behind. Here was a man who was the incumbent vice president. It was peacetime. The economy was doing well. All of the factors that usually lead to a big win. And he enters the Democratic convention 15 points behind George Bush. His people, watching both them falling behind and watching the popularity of Ralph Nader, he was getting 6 to 7% in the polls then, decide the only way to go is to reach out to where the sensibility of tens of millions of Americans are, which is a more populist direction, which is a position which is critical of large corporations. Polls in Business Week show that 80% of Americans think that big corporations have too much power, and the Gore people took this message. At the Democratic convention, he gave a strong populist speech where he pointed out the excesses of big tobacco, big oil, big polluters, and so on, and his public opinion polls shot up. And he was way ahead of George Bush after doing this for 3 weeks, and then they switched gears again and went back into their conservative mode of reaching out to the so-called swing voter. Here he was on the eve of debating a man who cannot debate, way ahead. They abandoned the populist rhetoric, and his ratings fall. So it's just the opposite. The public is very critical of large corporations, know they have too much power. That's why there's such a fight over the future of the party. The people in the traditional base of the party, unions and so on, recognize this failure, and they're going to fight for a candidate next time around who represents those values, not Al Gore not Bill Clinton, not this Democratic Leadership Council, which more and more is dependent on big money.
That was John Cavanagh, Executive Director of the Institute for Policy Studies. Contact IPS by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. According to the Federal Election Commission, Florida Congressman Lincoln Diaz-Balart's campaign accepted thousands of dollars in excessive and prohibited campaign contributions, with an additional $114,000 unaccounted for. Cited with 9 violations over the last 4 years, Diaz-Balart is the first member of Congress whose re-election campaign faces thousands of dollars in fines for failing to file contribution disclosure reports under new rules authorized by Congress. In April 2000, the FEC placed the report on the public record. The investigation showed that since 1993, excessive and unlawful contributions were made to the Balart campaign, and tens of thousands of dollars have since had to be refunded. The 13-page report reveals a money trail fraught with irregularities and a congressional office that was uncooperative and perhaps even deceitful. Miami-Dade Republican Congressman Lincoln Diaz-Balart has been a longtime anti-Castro advocate. He backed all efforts to tighten the U.S. embargo against Cuba, including the recent decision to codify the travel ban prohibiting U.S. tourists from visiting Cuba. His most recent appearance in the media spotlight was when he accompanied Elian Gonzalez to Disneyland and presented him with a puppy. Dan Christensen is an investigative journalist with the Miami-based Daily Business Review. He spoke with your reporter, Denise Manzari, about the ongoing audit of right-wing Cuban-American Congressman Lincoln Diaz-Balart.
There was a new program that the FEC has initiated that provides for fines for members of Congress that fail to file properly, and he was the first congressman who faces the possibility of being fined under that program. And in the course of that, I found out about the audit, and the key findings were that he had about $30,000 in illegal campaign contributions that he'd accepted during the 1997-98 campaign. And also there was about $114,000 in missing and unaccounted for cash that the FEC found. Apparently there was just bad record keeping. The FEC auditors said basically that there were no canceled checks, there were no invoices, and they couldn't track exactly what it was that the campaign was doing. And on top of it all, they cited what I sort of characterized as a reluctance to cooperate by the campaign staff people. Since 1998, the FEC has reported only auditing 5 members of Congress, including Diaz-Balart. So it was somewhat unusual. And the nature of the findings of the audit were unusual as well, from the best that I can tell.
Calling his office, there were several people that you spoke with, Anna Carbonell, who they are saying now is on a leave of absence. But technically, what she's doing is working full-time on this issue, I believe, and not taking any phone calls. They've also since hired a new accountant, Jose Riesco.
Yes.
And they've also taken on an attorney and political consultant, Trevor Potter.
Yes. He's one of the preeminent campaign compliance attorneys in Washington, as I understand it.
In calling the Federal Election Commission as well, they did say that there has been no official press release about this situation, and they've also said that they wouldn't state whether there really was an ongoing continued investigation or whether they will even release anything about it other than this report that was released in March of 2000.
Right. There are indications that the investigation is ongoing, but we have no definitive knowledge. I haven't been able to report that.
There was one of your articles titled "A Tax Break for a Trade Zone," and that talks about the Codina Group. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Armando Codina is a former business partner with our governor, Jeb Bush, and it was the Codina-Bush Group of real estate developers before the governor was elected. And the story that I wrote back in December was how
Congressman Diaz-Balart had filed a bill in Congress that would have saved Codina and his partners a lot of money on their property taxes by basically exempting them from property taxes for the Miami Free Trade Zone, which they own.
And that was filed basically a month after Codina gave $20,000 in soft money to the Republican National Committee.
I've talked to Mr. Codina about it. He says there's absolutely no connection, that he didn't ask Mr. Diaz-Balart to do this, that this was Diaz-Balart's own idea.
Armando Codina is a Cuban exile.
Yes, he is.
There was also another $25,000 in addition to that $20,000.
Yes, there was. I believe in the total for like either the year or 2 year cycle. I forget exactly what it was, but during that period, it was a total of about $45,000 that was donated either directly by Armando Codina or the Codina Group to the Republicans.
So the real story here is the interconnection of money and people and how it's being funneled to individuals like Lincoln Diaz-Balart and his campaign.
Well, that's part of it. I've looked at who the money was coming from, but one of the key stories in the series of stories that I've written had to do with the fact that the congressman had reported, or his campaign, I should say, had reported that back in February they had returned $30,000 in illegal contributions that they accepted during the 1998 campaign. But it turned out that they had not actually returned them. They didn't return them until after the first couple of stories about this appeared. And now, in addition to returning illegal contributions that were accepted a couple of years ago, they're also have started to return illegal contributions that were accepted for his most recent run for office last year. And the most notable contribution of that was from Dexter Leighton, who is a former U.S. attorney in Miami. He's also the husband of Ileana Ross Leighton, who is the congressman's colleague in the House of Representatives. But for me now, the story still is compliance problems.
What about the Cuban American National Foundation?
They have not come up in anything that I've written about.
In terms of direct money to Lincoln Diaz-Balart's campaign?
Frankly, I haven't looked at that, so I just don't know. I don't know if they contributed to him or not.
That was Dan Christensen, investigative journalist with the Daily Business Review, based in Miami. For more information, visit the website www.floridabiz.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Rich Frazier, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.